Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show podcast. Joining me is a man who has been front and center in the news and really target number one for the mainstream media for several years. Mark Judge did not put himself in that position. He was targeted because of his friendship with Brett Kavanaugh and the intent to take out Brett Kavanaugh at all costs by the mainstream media, starting with Christine Blasey Ford and her allegations against Kavanaugh and Mark in 2018. And Mark wrote a really good book. If you haven't read it yet, I would certainly recommend it. The Devil's Triangle, Mark Judge versus the New American Stasi. Very entertaining book, by the way. Which got mostly ignored by the mainstream media until about a month or so ago, Christine Blasey Ford reemerged to cash out on her fame with her own memoir. And that's where we're going to pick it up. Mark is with us right now. Mark, thank you so much for doing this. First off, it's great to talk to you person to person.
Ed, it's great to talk to a fellow Catholic, the hot air honcho. I've been a fan for years. So I'm delighted to be here. I'm serious. I have been a fan for years. That part I'm serious about.
Well, yeah, the rest of it's, you know, the honcho part, you know, it's just, I'm just the guy that they put in charge just to take the blame, you know, so yeah.
That's right. That's right. You get the psycho hate emails that come in.
Exactly. You know, because that makes my day, but not, certainly not to the extent that you got them. And sometimes from people who are actually supposed to be professionals, and you talk a lot about that in The Devil's Triangle, Mark Judge versus the New American Stasi. And I want to talk about the book, but I want to talk about what happened. Like, it was like 6 weeks ago, 7 weeks ago or so, maybe not even that long ago, that Blasey Ford's book came out. And immediately, the mainstream media swarmed to promote this book, and still, after several years, never even mentioned that there was another side to this story, with a couple of exceptions. Kathleen Parker at the Washington Post actually wrote an excoriating column about her colleagues. You sent that over to me, and I was stunned. And I mean, I think I wrote that hot air essay in about half an hour and got it up as soon as mm-hmm. I possibly could, because I was that mm-hmm. stunned that it actually ran in the Post.
Yeah, well, this goes back several years, but to distill it to its essence, after this nightmare that I lived, which we can talk about in detail if you want, I was not going to write a book about it. A friend of mine named John Smirak, who's an editor, said, well, you should write something about this. And I said, well, I'll write one or two pieces about it. And I was doing some research, and I was reading this book called The Education of Brett Kavanaugh by two New York Times reporters, Kate Kelly and Robin Pogerman. And towards the end of this book, there's one paragraph out of a 300-page book, and it says, in the summer of 2018, Christine Blasey Ford's friend, Keith Kogler — this is a verbatim quote from the New York Times, so I'm not quoting it out of my own head — was researching Mark Judge, his social media, his history, his videos, every move he was making, as well as Brett Kavanaugh's, the parties of the 1980s, Georgetown prep and everything. So, not to digress, the point I'm on is that I saw this and I said, well, wait a minute. If a friend of hers was oppo researching me, that's important, is it not? That this thing didn't come out of nowhere. And the second thing is that the letter she sent to her Congresswoman Eshoo, I believe, or Feinstein, which triggered this whole thing, I'm referred to in that letter as Mark G. Judge. So Brett Kavanaugh, with the assistance of his friend, Mark G. Judge. And I found that very interesting. And several others who are journalists have also, not liberal journalists, but some conservative ones, have said, well, that's a huge tell, because Mark G. Judge was a byline you used when you were a younger journalist. Nobody calls you Mark G. Judge these days. They call you Mark Judge. So it seems like they were researching you and they found this thing and they pulled it out. That, along with the oppo research stuff. And I thought, well, here are some questions I don't understand. And being a well-trained journalist with a lot of experience, I just started writing about it, and it slowly accumulated into a book. And I think it's intense and horrifying, and some of it's funny. But the main thing that was so shocking to me is, after spending a couple of years on this book and living in poverty, and, you know, I had two choices, Ed. It was, you know, lay low and just live the rest of your life, you know, working in a retail store, which is fine, or a restaurant, and die with dishonor, or write a book and die with honor. And I'm going to die with honor. So those couple of things, there were a couple other things, like he told Ruth Marcus at the Washington Post, I wanted to get in touch with Mark Judge over the summer of 2018, but, quote, I didn't know how. Okay. Okay. I'm a journalist. I'm a loudmouth. I'm on social media. I'm a pain in the butt, as a lot of people know, although, you know, I'm lovable too. But, and I'm thinking, how does someone not know how to get in touch with me? Because the adjunct to that is, I'm also a Catholic with a conscience. I have no recollection of the incident she describes. Ed, hand to God, before Jesus, if she had contacted me anytime that summer, I would have said, where do you want to meet? Bring the FBI, bring the Montgomery County Police, bring your family. I will come by myself. I have nothing to hide. Tell me where you want me to be. You know, I've been sober 30 years. If you've been harmed in some way, I want to make restitution to you. Tell me what happened. And the most enraging and heartbreaking thing is that that never happened. And the reason that never happened is because this was a orchestrated hit using me to bring down Brett. I hope that wasn't too long-winded, but that's my dissertation.
No, I mean, absolutely. And many of us understand that, right? Having gone through that, having raised all sorts of questions initially about this claim from, it would have been 36 years ago, I think, at the time in 2018, without any dates, you know, places or anything, it smelled bad right from the very beginning.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but not that there weren't any dates. The dates kept changing. Remember, but her initial thing was, this happened in the mid-1980s. They were trying to attach me to Brett. So, okay, it happened in the mid-1980s. Well, wait a minute. Mark's at Catholic University in Washington. Brett's at Yale. They're hundreds of miles apart. That doesn't work. So let's rejigger the date. I mean, I'm sorry, continue, but they were giving different dates. It was insane.
Yeah. Right. The whole thing was insane. And it became obvious. I mean, again, you should read The Devil's Triangle, because especially in the first part of the book, Mark goes through this in a lot of detail. There's more to the book than that, though, by the way. There's all sorts of really interesting, sort of almost a stream of consciousness memory of Georgetown Prep and the years there, which is really fascinating. And I want to get to that in a second, but because I want to talk about childhoods. Right. And okay. Just, you know, I'm not going to compare things. I think that we had some things in common, some things not necessarily, but it was all. Well, let's get into it. I mean, the stuff that you describe here in the book, I don't think it was exactly the same thing that I was doing. We're only a year apart, and we were only 2 years apart in school, right? I'm a year older than you are, and I was up a year, so I was 2 years ahead of you in school. I graduated in 1980. And I mean, it's the same time period, different location. I was in Southern California, so it wasn't a prep situation. It was public school. We were doing most of the same stuff that you guys were doing, and none of it was really meaningful, right? I mean, it's nothing that you would go back and say, well, you know, this is awful. And including, up to and including, the humor. I mean,
right.
I wouldn't necessarily stand behind it, but, you know, today, but I mean, we were all part of Monty Python, National Lampoon. We were all doing stuff like that. I had a handful of friends and I that did, I think we called it electroshock therapy, was our comedy group. And it was all farts and, you know, potty humor and sex humor and stuff like that. And God help me if that stuff ever gets out, because now I know what's going to happen after watching what happened. It was meaningless. It's kids trying to figure out their place in the universe. And you know, I think you speak very movingly about some of the people, some of the leadership in the school that were trying to help form you along the way. And I really found that interesting. for most of us in public schools on the West Coast, it was like, yeah, well, you know, don't kill anybody and don't kill yourself, and we'll see, we'll let you graduate either way.
Yeah, well, it's true, and we were also coming out of a cultural time that has passed, which is sort of in the wake of the Vietnam War, the 1970s. The drinking age had been lowered to 18 during Vietnam. Much less parental supervision, which was good and bad. It wasn't all bad. Some of it was good because you sort of learned how to fend for yourself. But also that Mad Magazine, Monty Python, Rolling Stone thing, where it's like, should we do something obnoxious and puerile and kind of stupid? Yes, we should. And that was, you're right, that was part of the culture back then. And I think a lot of that is healthy for kids. I think it's healthy for kids to do things like we did a little underground newspaper that was in the media that the Washington Post wrote about. They wrote about the Unknown Hoya, our little newspaper. And it's sad because, you know, the Stasi love to quash creativity, and our modern Stasi loves to not only hurt people and kill them, but also to quash creativity. And when I was talking to Fox and I told him at our 40th high school reunion last year, me and two of the yearbook editors went back to the yearbook office and smoked cigars and put our feet up, because we said, we are not going to be ashamed about sex jokes and fart jokes and parties. And when we were 18 years old, it's like, we're not going to be embarrassed by that because we didn't rape anybody. We didn't kill anybody. And kids need that kind of freedom. And just as an addendum to that, the only time I laughed during that whole thing in 2018 was when one of the editors of the former editors of the Unknown Hoya called me when they were talking about the Unknown Hoya. It's like some senator was talking about it. A guy at the Washington Post had just written about it. And he was saying, you know, the Unknown Hoya celebrates kegs and girls and parties and blah, 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 blah. And my phone rings and it's one of the guys I edited the thing with. And he said, hey, Mark, did you see like they're talking about the Unknown Hoya? And I said, yes, they're talking about what we wrote about. And there was a perfect timing. There was a pause and he goes, is it too late to print a retraction? So he had his sense of humor. To this day, he had that sort of David Letterman thing, which was, you know, humor's based on truth. And that joke was about these people are absolute blanking idiots to be obsessed with this stuff. And we are not going to run and hide and be ashamed of it. We're not going to be super duper proud of, you know, fart jokes and stuff like that. But we were kids. Yeah, but and I said to one interviewer, you know, compare the mental health of us teenagers in the 1980s to the teenagers now. I mean, whose mental health was stronger? You know, because we had this mystical component to our existence that is no longer there. And I've talked to people about this. When you went out clubbing in the 1980s or something, when I was in college in DC or even in high school, late high school, you were completely separated from the world. You were cut off from your parents, from your job, from school, from everything. And I just remember going from club to club to club in DC some nights, and it was almost like you'd be in touch with God in a way, because you'd hear music, you'd go to bars, you'd go to poetry readings, you'd do all that cultural stuff. And it was rejuvenating, because you were like Huck and Jim on the raft. You were totally cut off from civilization. And when Americans are deprived of that, I think they slowly go mad. But I got way off on a digression there, but you know what I'm talking about.
Well, I mean, and this is kind of the stuff that I want to talk about, because this is the type of stuff that got weaponized, right? I mean, the very notion that you're going to go back and have, you know, not to name names, but Sheldon Whitehouse, bastard,
a cross between Sylvester the Cat and Torquemada. That's how I would think of him.
Yeah, I'm not naming names, but Sheldon freaking Whitehouse, you know, deciding that he needed to get to the bottom of the term boof. I mean, first right. off, he's a moron, because what he was thinking was boff, which is a different word with a different meaning. Boof. If you were a teenager in the late 70s and early 1980s, you probably could figure out the difference between boofing and boffing.
Right, right.
Both but fun. There was also, they're both fun.
Yeah. But there was also a deadly serious component to that. That was the more idiotic and lighter side of it. But there was also stuff like accusing, you know, us of serial gang rapes and drugging girls. I had to tell the FBI, you know, I couldn't identify a Quaalude if you showed it to me. I wouldn't know what one looked like. They were saying we were giving Quaaludes to girls, and the whole thing kicked off, and this was the nut out of which it all grew. When I got a call from Ronan Farrow, I'm sitting at home taking care of my elderly mother, and I get a call from Ronan Farrow. He says, you've been mentioned in this letter alleging or accusing you of sexual misconduct. It hadn't been elevated to assault at that point. And I said, and this is verbatim, and Ronan Farrow has never disputed this. I said, who's the accuser? He said, I can't tell you that. I said, where did this allegedly take place? He said, I can't tell you that. I said, when did this allegedly take place? He said, sometime in the 1980s. And when that came out, do you remember Ala Pundit when he wrote for Hot Air?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So the next day or the day after that, Ala Pundit has this piece up where he says, this is Kafkaesque. Mark Judge has been embroiled in this thing involving a Supreme Court nominee, and he isn't told where or when or who this, anything about this.
Yeah.
And having a father who worked for National Geographic and had written about communist countries, he came to mind, and I thought, we're not in America anymore. I was like, we're not in America anymore. So don't delude yourself to thinking you're in America right now, because you are not.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it absolutely true. Not the America that we grew up with in the 1970s and 1980s, which was already starting to trend a little bit in that direction. This is full on thought police mode, really, honestly. I mean, this is something out of Orwell. The idea that you're going to want to get a comment from somebody without giving them the specifics of what the accusation was. And the reason why they couldn't do that is because the accusation itself was ambiguous. It was literally malleable to whatever. If you had provided a response, it would have been reworked to work around that response, right?
Right, right. But here's what they were looking for. Like, I drank too much when I was younger, and it got bad in the mid 1980s when I was in college, and I was doing a lot of goofy stuff, not a lot of criminal stuff. But I think when she said the mid 1980s, and I think when they wouldn't give me a specific date, they wanted me to provide it to them and then add Kavanaugh to the mix. So yeah, in the mid 1980s, I slept with this waitress or something. Da, 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 da. Well, was Brett Kavanaugh there? No, he was hundreds of miles away. I hadn't talked to him since high school. Da, da. But that wouldn't work. So they were trying to attach these two things, like me in the mid 1980s to Brett Kavanaugh. But because we were hundreds of miles apart, because my life was so different from his then, it wasn't working. So that's why they couldn't be specific. It was a total scam.
You know, Mark, I do want to get back to Ford's memoir and what happened after that came out. But I want to ask you a question that you kind of raise in the book in different ways, which is, I think that they landed on the two people who were struggling with addiction problems to either bolster the story or become the villains in it. And obviously you're one, and Leland Kaiser is the other. And I mean, Leland Kaiser's been, you know, trying to keep a low profile ever since, but they were using her addiction issues to try to manipulate her. And I think that that's what they were trying to do with you too. I mean, do you get that sense that they landed on you and then Leland specifically for that purpose?
Yes, but I also, unlike Leland, I have a big mouth and I've written a lot of stuff. And so, you know, I sort of, I was more vocally out there than she was. But absolutely, yes. And Ed, there was also, and again, even conservative journalists are elliptical about this or don't confront it directly. We are talking about extortion and witness tampering.
Yes,
that's what we are talking about. We are talking about Leland Kaiser being told, bad things can be said about you unless you change your story. We were talking about me getting a phone call on September 24th, 2018 from a California number, which the FBI has, saying, you like effing with people. I like effing with people too. You need to change your story. We were talking about direct criminal activity against me and Leland Kaiser. And maybe they didn't bargain for a couple of things. One, I come from a proud Irish Catholic family, and it's death before dishonor. And when people were speculating that I might be suicidal or I might not survive this, I thought, I will die before going to that freak show they're trying to drag me to. I will not die with that dishonor. And that Leland Kaiser, who's in recovery, also learns things. Well, I can't speak for her, but
right,
we both know things about telling the truth and being honest. And my entire thing this during this whole deal was, had I seen this happen, I simply would have said so. I just would have said so. I could have made myself the hero. Yeah, I saw this happen. I jumped in and broke it up, and I'm an upstanding citizen and da 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 da. But as I told the FBI, that would have been a lie. It would have been a lie to say that. So I'm sorry. I'm kind of all over the map, but you see where I'm going.
No. I mean, this is, first off, this is supposed to be a conversation. So feel free to go all over the map, because all of this.
No F-bombs though, Ed. No F-bombs. Don't worry.
Well, we're not on the air.
Right.
But yeah. I get it. Yeah, we're both supposed to be good Catholic boys, and even though you know.
That's right. Good Irish Catholic boys. Morrissey's not Irish.
Not at all. No, there's nothing Irish or Catholic about Morrissey. But you know, the reason why I think all of this is it needs to be revisited. First off, because Ford wrote that memoir, and a lot of this context has since sort of slipped away, but because it's going to happen again, this same thing is going to happen again. The next time there is a necessity to torpedo either a politician or a nominee, you know, especially a judicial nominee, that we're going to see the same process happen all over again. And you're going to get the point of this, I am convinced, and I'd like to hear your perspective on this, was to get somebody who would be at least somewhat credible to do this so that they could start getting more accusations. They could start generating more accusations. And you had Julie Swetnick, who you mentioned, who is just absolutely, you know, insane. And then was it Deborah Ramirez at Yale, I think you mentioned recovered memory in The Devil's Triangle in relation to Ford, but I think that was also the case with Deborah Ramirez too, is that basically they were telling her, this is what really happened, right? So you can, come out and join the party. And that's kind of what that was to me as well. And I wrote about it at the time. It's like, this is completely unreliable. They're basically feeding their information. And when she regurgitates it, oh, well, there it is. They're going to do this again.
I don't know if I agree with that, simply because they were foiled. I mean, listen, I think Laura Ingraham reported that there was not jubilation, but good cheer and happiness on the plane where Christine Blasey Ford was coming to D.C. to testify. They were in a very upbeat, good mood, because they had found me and I was an easy hit and I was roadkill. And they thought, well, this is going to be over in 2 days because this guy's just going to roll over. And a lot of people haven't examined this as closely as I have, but if you look at it logically, if their plan was, we involve Mark Judge, he flips, he rolls over, he says all this bad stuff about Kavanaugh, we kill the nomination, we celebrate and go home. So that's the plan. They arrive in D.C. Well, wait a minute. Mark Judge hasn't said anything yet. It's the next day. Okay, it's been 24 hours. Mark Judge hasn't spoken yet. It's been 48 hours. Desperation starts to set in. Okay, Mark Judge has not said anything yet. There's a video of Michael Avenatti on September 24th, my birthday. And Ed, this is important. And he says my name 13 times in 2 minutes. He says it 13 times in 2 minutes at a press conference. He was frustrated. They were all frustrated because their plan was not working. And thus the delays. Eventually, Mark Judge is going to come out and not necessarily say Brett Kavanaugh assaulted Christine Blasey Ford, but he will say Brett Kavanaugh drank a lot. We went to parties. We did the. He will undo him at some point. And to them, it was going to be easy. Hey, we're going to land in D.C. This thing will be over in 48 hours. But as the frustration mounted and mounted and mounted, which, and people miss this, which accounts for the fear of flying bunkum. that garbage she said about, I have to drive across the country because of fear of flying. The fear of flying thing ties tightly 100% into me not testifying because right. they were panicking and they had to delay. She had no fear of flying. She was going surfing in Tahiti on a little plane. So does that make logical sense to you that they were delaying because I wasn't coming forward? And having not come forward and foiled them, I don't know, to answer your question, if they'll try it again. I'm not sure they'll try it again. I don't know if there's anyone out there who could say F you like I did, but I don't think they'd try it again.
Well, I'll tell you why I say that. Because, yes, it didn't work. In the end, he was confirmed on a straight party line boat. There may have been one Democrat who crossed over. I just don't recall specifically at the time. It was pretty much a party line boat. But they attached a ruinous stigma to Brett Kavanaugh in the same way they did with Clarence Thomas, and Anita Hill is still the toast of the left for that. And that was 33 years ago. And I think that maybe what they really wanted was to derail the nomination, but they were willing to settle for, well, we've just made everything that he does illegitimate. And in the long run, I think that they may not have gotten their first choice, but they got their second choice out of it. And that's the reason why I say it's going to happen again unless people really step up.
And yes, I was going to say agreed for the most part, except Kathleen Parker wrote this amazing column fantastic. A week ago that was all about, you know, Christine Blasey Ford has enriched herself by hurting other people. This was not justice. The tactics were insane. And when you have a Pulitzer Prize winner in the pages of the Washington Post saying, why are my colleagues too afraid to even mention Mark Judge's book? That's a little different from Anita Hill, I think. I think that's a major blow to their reputation annihilation plan.
Well, I certainly hope you're right. And I give Kathleen Parker tremendous credit and the Washington Post, who could have spiked that column if they really wanted to do so. I give them both a lot of credit for running that column on the 31st, March 31st. And that's the reason when you pointed it out to me the next day, it was like, first off, I was thinking, everybody's going to think this is an April Fool's joke.
Yeah.
Everybody's going to think this is an April Fool's joke. Yeah. But you know, it was got a lot of attention, and it should. Because it's one of the few times where I think that people that a really credible voice in the mainstream media really talked about what happened in 2018 and not just in terms of, you know, Justice Kavanaugh, who is on the Supreme Court and has put this behind him and seems to be happy. I mean, I don't know if you're still in touch with him or not. I hope he is. I hope it's past him and he's satisfied and he's just going to put his head, you know, just keep looking forward and not think about the past. But also you and Leland Kaiser and how you were victimized and how Leland Kaiser was victimized by this. And that's the reason why the memoir, the Ford memoir, and the media rush to promote it was pretty infuriating. But, and Mark, I want to ask you about this. Were you surprised at how short that cycle was?
Well, I knew it was going to be short because I understand media really, really well. And I knew instinctively, okay, people are not ready for this. They don't want this right now. And the second thing was, of course, you know, yes, Leland Kaiser and I were victimized. And I can get into that a little bit later because it crushed my freelance writing career. And I'm a proud person who likes to work, but it's resulted in some dire circumstances. But what I'm getting at is that I have a lawyer who's a TV producer, and he stayed up all night reading Ford's book. And of course, I'm on pins and needles because I'm thinking, well, what are they going to accuse me of now? Like, did I interfere with the outfielder during that Cubs game and ruin the World Series? Like, what, you know, what next are they going to accuse me of?
I know what you're talking about when you say that.
I can't believe I pulled Bart Whiteman. Yeah. Interfered with the,
yeah.
Wow. But, But although my grandfather was a baseball player for the Senators, and he hit a foul ball that Babe Ruth chased, and Babe Ruth hit a wall and knocked himself out. And if you find the picture, it's my grandfather hit that foul ball. It's totally true. Look it up. But to get to your point, so this lawyer stays up all night reading Ford's book. And the next day he calls me, and I'm thinking, here we go again. And he said, well, I got some really good news for you. And he said, I'm a lawyer, and you were mentioned only a few times in this book. And the only time you were mentioned, and this is very important, is via official government documents, transcripts of Senate hearings, interviews with her, only official documents. And he said, what does that mean to you, Mark? I said, I don't know what that means. He said, let me tell you what it means, because I'm a lawyer. They don't want you owning St. Martin's Press. Okay.
I knew exactly what the answer was going to be. Yeah, defamation.
They said if they leave themselves as open as RFK Stadium to a lawsuit if they go out of that. So he said, this is great news for you because you're in here a few times. And it's such BS, Ed, because she's in interviews going, I just wanted to focus on my surfing and my life and my family and how I got through this and everything. That's a lot of garbage. And you're a scammer. Answer the questions that I pose in my book. You are one of your lawyers or one of your team members in the committee who wrote this book. When Brett was announced on January 9th, Emma Brown at the Washington Post met with Christine Blasey Ford on July 10th, the day after. On July 11th, Emma Brown sent me this innocuous, friendly email. Hi, I'm from the Washington Post. I'm doing a story about Georgetown Prep and Brett Kavanaugh. Doesn't mention Blasey Ford, doesn't mention anything. I don't answer it because I know the Washington Post is arsenic. Then the story breaks, and Emma Brown had interviewed Leland Kaiser a couple of days before the story came out. Leland Kaiser had denied this whole thing. Emma Brown was in Leland Kaiser's house in Maryland interviewing her. And when the story breaks that explodes on September 16th, Leland Kaiser is not in the story. And as Kimberly Strassel said in a tweet thread for the Wall Street Journal, you know, wow, you had an exonerating witness for these guys who said she doesn't know Kavanaugh, has no recollection of this. And oh, I'm about to curse. I got to cork it down. You know, you were in, I pray to the Blessed Mother, and she has helped me through more things. I can't even tell you. She keeps me sane. But you were in this person's house interviewing them 48 hours ago. You've completely upended this entire thing and the entire nation. And I'll say this and shut up, but for 5 years, I've been asking Emma Brown, both on social media and in public forums like this, why was Leland Kaiser left out of your story? And she's too much of a chicken to answer that question.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that the Washington Post editors really should be answering that question too, as much as the praise we just gave them for allowing Parker to run her column. Washington Post editors should be answering that question as well, because that's part of their job, is to make sure that the stories that they print are complete and not nonsense. And that has always been it's not the only flaw, but it's always been one big flaw in Ford's claim, which is that the people that she said were witnesses don't have any recollection of any such incident taking place with Brett Kavanaugh or anybody else.
Right. And in a small, tight-knit Irish Catholic community where if a boyfriend and girlfriend had an argument at a party, Ed, everyone knew the next day.
Right. Yeah, right? That was true in public school, too. I can tell you that was pretty much true.
Okay. You guys didn't get away with anything either, huh? Out on the West Coast. I thought California was more freewheeling.
Oh, we got away with stuff, but just not with each other. The adult.
Okay.
I'm not going to claim that we didn't get away with stuff, Mark. I'm just saying that the adults really didn't glom onto
the kids these days don't understand. Like back in the 70s and 80s, you'd leave the house for 8 or 10 hours. Your parents had no idea where you were.
Nor did they worry, right? They weren't looking.
Nor did they care
to find you. Yeah, well, I don't know if they didn't care, but they weren't trying to find you because it was normal. You know, these are the days, and this is a little earlier than that. You know, when we were younger kids in the early and mid 70s, when what you were told was, get out of the house, don't come back until dinner time. You know, stop watching TV all day long. Get out of the house, go play with your friends, and come back when the street lights come on. And if you didn't do that, we had this one neighbor across the street from us that we called the Iron Lung, because when her kids didn't come back when the streetlights came out, she would just scream their names down the street.
Yeah. Well, we had the parents with the distinct whistles or the distinct sounds to call us in. Like one had the cowbell, yeah. One had like the military whistle. Everyone had their distinct sound, and you'd all go, "Oh, it's time to go in." And you learned not like, I don't believe in necessarily this conservative thing of rugged individualism. I don't believe on depending on the government, but there's a middle ground, and we learned that growing up. Like you had your crew, had your buddies and your friends, and they would pull you through. So that's the healthy middle ground, I think.
So since Ford's memoir came out, obviously, I think, did you get a chance to talk to Kathleen Parker, or was she just working off of the record?
She was just working off the records. Yeah.
So how many people have reached out to you to tell the story since Ford's memoir came out?
Fox? There's actually a documentary that's 45 minutes long on Fox Nation called Judge and the Justice. And it's all about this thing. And I think it just went up about a week ago. And I'm not sure a lot of people know about it. I haven't watched the whole thing straight through just because it's traumatizing to relive this. Right. I mean, it really is. But there was an interview with Martha McCallum, which was also difficult to do because, you know, I mean, they really, really had to drag me through that because having, you know, attempted extortion, gang rapes, all this stuff, you're terrified. Well, what are they going to, you know, blitz me with now? But I did it. So let me answer your question. So Fox and Martha McCallum, and again, on Fox Nation, there's this documentary. The Washington Times, Susan Ferriccio at the Washington Times wrote an unfavorable article. She's a good interviewer too. She was very thorough and was asking good questions. Not even questions favorable to me, just good, honest journalism questions.
Sure.
And I got to say this might get me in trouble, but, you know, I was doing a lot of freelance writing and not having as much economic trouble as I am right now. And a lot of the conservatives abandoned me too. And Joseph Bottom did not abandon me. He was like worked at the Weekly Standard. He's a well-known, you know, very elegant conservative writer. And he put up a tweet and he said, you know, and I know Jody, I've used to write for him at the Weekly Standard a lot. And he said, you know, Mark Judge is out there washing dishes, which is fine. That's good, honest work. I got no problem with that. But the tweet said, and it's disgusting that even the conservatives who ran his writing will not defend him. I mean, you don't have to make me the editor-in-chief of National Review. I'd probably suck at that job. But, you know, I'm a damn good journalist. My stuff drives a lot of traffic. I lost like half my freelance contacts. I was like borderline homeless for a while. And I got no problem with working at Home Depot and washing dishes. That's good, honest work. And finally, this dude came along and he started not even a GoFundMe, but it was like a distinct, you know, separate from GoFundMe thing. And that raised some money. I could pay the lawyer. I could take care of stuff. And again, if you want to make a long-term financial commitment to something, do it for Hot Air or something that's doing this good work every day and everything. But short-term, I had people going, man, you were abandoned by everybody. And again, you have pride and you aren't like, hey, man, where's my reward? That's not the spiritual mentality. And I read this book called The Razor's Edge by Somerset Maugham about the value of manual labor and the spiritual path and all that stuff. But the liberals are Stasi and they're evil and they want to kill you. But a lot of conservatives did not crown themselves with glory during this. And I understand it was red hot. I understand people were terrified of getting sucked into the dragnet. But, I'll just say this and shut up. The last thing is, Helen Andrews wrote this great essay in First Things called Shame Storm. And it's about what happens to people who get publicly shamed by this. And she just went through all the suicides, all the people who have committed suicide. Yeah. And you do have suicidal ideation, which as a happy person, is terrifying because you've never had that before. And you're like, okay, I'm poor. I'm borderline homeless. No one will hire me. And I'm having suicidal ideation. And it's like, this is what Helen Andrews is talking about. This is how this ends. And A, I'm afraid of hell because I'm a primitive atavistic Catholic. And B, I'm just like, our family doesn't go out like that. We do not go out that way. If you have to wash dishes, you wash dishes, and we're not going out that way. But I'm sure you can understand how the mental turmoil was savage. It was absolutely brutal, but I believe in getting past it and getting better and moving on. But, buy the book, hit the GoFundMe. I have a Give, Send, Go for people who don't like GoFundMe. And again, I'm not one of these guys you're going to see in a year or 2 years going, remember me? Put $20 into the till. I just got to get through a little pinch of a period here, and I can work in a restaurant or any other place like that. But resentment is toxic. I don't want to sound resentful, but part of me is like, damn, like Jonathan Turley told Fox News, Jonathan Turley told Martha McCallum, he was roadkill. Mark Judge was roadkill. But I'm still here, Ed. I'm still throwing haymakers.
You are. And, I know that you're writing for, you're still doing some freelance writing, because I get a chance to link to you from time to time in the headlines. And you're one of my favorite writers in that regard. Anytime I get something from you, I'm trying to put it into the headlines, because I want to make sure that people know that you're still out there and you're still slugging away. And we'll talk more about that later, maybe another time. But we're going to include the link to Mark's book, The Devil's Triangle, Mark Judge versus the New American Stasi. We're going to put a link into the GoFundMe. And if you want to send me the I forget what you said the other one
the
was.
The Give, Send, Go for people who Give, don't send, like GoFundMe. Yeah.
Yeah. If you want to send me the link to that, we'll make sure it goes up in the show post that I'm going to write about this. And there's still lots to talk about. We'll just invite you back another time. We'll talk more about some of the other things that are going on here. We're getting to a point here where I think that we're sort of reaching the functional limit of podcasting in terms of attention spans these days.
I hear you.
But look, hang in there, brother. Good to talk to you. It's really good to connect with you this way. I hope you're going to do this. I hope you can come back and we can talk more about whatever. It doesn't have to be this. It can be whatever you want to talk about. And in the meantime, be well, God bless you. And, thanks for your determination, well nigh onto stubbornness, which is good.
Thank you, Ed. And I can only close with one of my favorite lines from the most conservative movie ever made, 300, we were the Spartans during that whole thing. When Leonidas says, to Xerxes, who's like the tyrant who represents all left-wing movements. And Xerxes says, just kneel before me. And Leonidas says, I'm not going to kneel. And the world will know that brave men stood up against the tyrant, that few stood against the many. And at the end of the day, even a God king can bleed. And that's it. Because the liberal God king, if you stand up, can bleed. Never forget that.
Amen. Mark Judge, The Devil's Triangle, Mark Judge versus the New American Stasi. Buy that book and read what really happened. Thank you again, Mark, and we will talk again soon, sir.
Great to see you, Ed.